Welcome back to The Word at Work. This is the podcast for Christian professionals, where we dig into topics to support you in thriving professionally and, of greatest importance, living biblically. I'm your host, Miranda Carles. Well, if you get something good out of this podcast, please leave a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Even if you don't listen on one of those two platforms, I know a lot of y'all listen on the web browser or one of the other many platforms that this show is pushed out to, but leaving a five-star review on one of those two specific platforms, so either Apple or Spotify, is really helpful as we continue to spread the reach of this content. And thank you for continuing to share the show with others. That helps us to grow. So keep sharing it with friends who could use the encouragement as they seek to integrate their faith at work. Well, I am really excited about today's topic. Today, we have the honor of welcoming Dr. Neil Shenvey to the show to discuss why we have reason to believe in Christianity and therefore entrust our lives to Christ and worship Him alone. Neil and his wife have four children. He has worked as a research scientist at Yale University and Duke University and has published over 30 peer-reviewed papers. Neil is also the author of Why Believe? A Reasoned Approach to Christianity. It's going to be a great conversation. Let's dig into today's topic. Neil, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm really excited about this conversation.
Thank you for inviting me, Miranda.
Yeah, most people start digging into the topic of Christian apologetics, which we'll be talking about today. Most people seem to start digging into that because of a certain challenging experience or a felt need that they've had. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal history of getting into the topic of logical reasons for Christianity? What got you pulled into that?
My experience may have been different from other people's, ironically, because I was raised in a non-Christian home. My parents are not believers. And so I started, my baseline was secular. I was spiritual, but not religious, and never really went to church growing up. Didn't read the Bible. I read it all the way through in high school because I wanted to say I was educated and had read the Bible, but never had real, I believed in God actually, but I was not a Christian. Although I would have called myself a Christian because it's kind of culturally, you know, you're in America, you believe in God, you're a Christian. And I didn't really, so I went to college, and one of the classes that I took there was called the New Testament and Christian Origins, taught by John Gager. We used Bart Ehrman's book as a text, and it for the Christian students, it was very challenging because it was operating from a wholly skeptical, critical framework. It was called the Faith Buster for Christians at the time. So I enjoyed it as a non-Christian. So I kind of was coming from this place where I was not a Christian. I was totally comfortable in my unbelief and I had no challenges to it that I was aware of. But then I became a Christian later in graduate school, and not exactly through the traditional, through apologetics. But interestingly, I had just enough understanding of the New Testament that I knew that Jesus really existed, that the Bible gave a roughly accurate outline of his life. I mean, very roughly, like he had disciples, he hung out with prostitutes and sinners, and he was crucified. But I knew it wasn't a legend. He's not a fairy tale. But that's all you really need to say, what if it's true, though? I mean, we can't prove historically that he didn't rise from the dead. We can't prove he didn't atone for sin. And those are sort of the two central elements of the gospel in 1 Corinthians 15. So just that barest of the crack through which the daylight came through was what led me to consider whether Christianity might be true. And we can go into exactly how that happened. But then only later, when I encountered other non-Christians who were asking me, well, can you defend your beliefs rationally? That's when I began to really dig into apologetics, like, you know, the basic stuff like Lee Strobel's Case for Christ, C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, and began to say, work out, okay, well, I believe this, and I sincerely have good reasons to think it's true experientially, but how do I defend it relationally to other people that I know?
Yeah, it's interesting how you said at that point, as you were coming into college and a younger person, you didn't grow up in a Christian home, but still would have called yourself a Christian by name, just culturally, because you were in America and believed in God. It feels like things are a little bit different than that now, would you say, where maybe a young person today wouldn't have that as a base cultural norm?
I think that's right. Although I think that the poll data shows that the number of professing Christian people just say that, yes, I'm a Christian, is going down steadily. But I think it's still a large fraction of the U.S. would say mm-hmm. I'm a Christian. So I think maybe in academic circles, maybe in professional circles, it is no longer the case that the default is mm-hmm. you're a Christian. But I think in a larger context, I would say probably, you know, half of the U.S. say, roughly, I don't know,
sure,
pull numbers, would just say, yeah, I believe in God, I'm a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was raised in a very Christian home. My parents were and still are incredible examples of walking with God. Like, we always used the Bible as the foundation for how we lived and functioned as a family. So I was taking that into university setting and having to kind of armor up a little bit and survive have my faith survive being in the university setting, whereas you did kind of the opposite of that, come in and then build upon coming from a very different background. So that's interesting. I think it was in your book where you talked about going to a church, I think while you were at university, and looking around and seeing so many intellectuals that you had known in other circles, and seeing them at church. What was your perception of that at the time?
Yeah, so one of the big obstacles for me in even considering Christianity was the idea that it was for dumb people, and I was super smart. So I don't even have to bother investigating whether these things are true, because it's for the, you know, rednecks, the uneducated, the people that are weak and need help. And it's, I thought, you know, it's very, and so condescending. I was like, it's good for them because they need help, and it's good for them to believe that they just have something better than their miserable lives. Just so arrogant. But then running into people who were clearly intellectual, clearly sophisticated and smart, and smarter than me even. I wouldn't have said that. But, you know, my quantum physics professor was a renowned cosmologist, is a renowned cosmologist. And he sang in the choir at the church that my future wife took me to. Uh-huh. And our pastor had a PhD from Cambridge. So things just little, they didn't have to say, oh, I'm smart. They didn't say that I'm smart, but they just seeing them there, I was like, wait a minute, I can't just write this off. I can't just say, oh, this guy, oh yeah, sure, he has a PhD in cosmology, but he's totally irrational when it comes to untrustworthy. Well, I can't say that. I have to actually consider, is this religion thing actually true? And that was a free, and it's just these really small cracks in my armor that through which God worked to convert me.
Yeah, that's so interesting. We had Dave Evans on a few weeks ago. I actually hadn't even known that he was a Christian until a year or so ago. He co-wrote that book, Designing Your Life. It's based on Stanford design theory, and it's a bestseller from a very secular standpoint. He's a Stanford guy. He worked with Steve Jobs and led the design of Apple's first mouse and laser pointer. And I didn't know, but he's an evangelical Christian. We had him on, and I just know people look at him and same thing. They think, well, yeah, well, if that guy believes, I'm going to look into it a little bit more. So I think that's just a funny thing, how we can view that. And I think it speaks to the amount of logical evidence and reason there is to believe as well. I think that's kind of the message that it sends to folks. I mentioned this episode is going to air right before a conversation that we have with Peter Gurry on the story of how we got the Bible and why we can trust it. And so I do hope that listeners will continue to seek out Christian apologetics resources and information to support not only their own faith, but also conversations that they have with others. But there is, I feel like, especially today and especially in the workplace, there is a great temptation to just avoid making absolute truth claims about Christianity. So what are your thoughts on that? The question of, should we avoid religious truth claims for maybe the sake of peace?
Well, I think Christians can't do that, because the ultimate peace is between us and God. And mm-hmm. so there can be no real peace unless there's peace between the individual human being and their creator. So to say, well, I don't want to rock the boat, it's like If you think even for a second about what you're saying, it just rings so hollow. I know it's we'd like to maintain that distance and have an excuse, but people are going to hell without Christ. That's just the reality. And I, you know, it's like I am just as squeamish as anybody when it comes to going, you know, evangelizing. But we have to ask ourselves, we have to, you know, be hard-nosed and say, do I believe it or not? If you know, think about, this is a great example coming off the heels of COVID. You know, COVID happened and there's all kinds of information flying around and people had strong opinions, but you know, people that were, I think rightly, where this is a serious disease, well, they made it known. They were out there and yeah, people that didn't believe it. They're like, yeah, we don't really care what you do. You know, take it easy. But people that believe this is a deadly disease should take it seriously. They were out there on social media. They were talking to their friends, get vaccinated, mm-hmm. do all these things. Well, there's an example of people that actually had the courage of their convictions. And I have to, you know, we cannot lie to ourselves and say, no, I really believe this. And I'm not a coward. I'm just, well, what are you then? Why aren't you there acting as if it's a matter of life and death? And I'm talking to myself too, but we have to get serious. I think it's just easy for us to say, well, I'll put it off. I'll be a faithful presence. And that's, I'm not denying that. Yeah. Like people, God reached me through people just being there, but we can do more than that. We can, you know, people that were huge proponents of the COVID vaccine were not just saying, I'm just going to quietly be vaccinated and people ask me about it. No, they were out there saying, this is really important. I care about you. I love you. I want you to get vaccinated too. So I think that's an example of how this is not about COVID. This is just about the idea. Right. If you really believe it's a matter of life and death, then you are out there making your beliefs known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're instructed to go and tell the world, but I think one of the enemy's biggest tools is just that fear of man. And sometimes that fear of man is just fear of a comment or a little bit of pushback or maybe an eye roll or a dirty look. And we let that get in the way so much. And we say it's for the sake of peace. But to your point, there's so much at stake here. So good. I'm glad we're having these conversations. I think I've shared this on the podcast before, but when I think of apologetics, I think back to an interaction that I had with a client a few years ago. He was a Christian. I knew he was a Christian. He was an engineer and worked with a bunch of engineers. And there's all those stereotypes about engineers. And he shared that he kept his faith just really completely hidden at work. Didn't want anyone to even know he was a Christian, wouldn't even mention, hey, I'm going to this barbecue at my church after work. Mm-hmm. And many of his colleagues and work friends didn't believe. And he was worried, and this goes back to that fear of man, he was worried that they would question his intelligence if they knew he was a Christian. Now, of course, there's all sorts of, again, topics around the fear of man and things we can get into there, but it stuck out to me that this man didn't feel that he had any logical evidence to hang his hat on or to share with others to make a reasonable defense for his Christian faith or for the God of the Bible. So he experienced what I think many face, especially if they're working in really secular workplaces. There are a lot of different belief systems and different worldviews in our world and in our workplaces. So what sets Christianity apart from all the others in your mind?
Well, I think the obvious answer is that Christianity is true. But the person, how do you convince people that it's true? That's the question. So what sets it apart? Well, it's true. It's a revealed religion. But then how do we convey that? How do we show that? And I think that there are two, you know, people ask me, why are you a Christian? I think there are two go-to things I would say that are both kind of brief. But one would be that Christianity explains the deepest truths about my condition as a human being. And explains everybody's deepest truths. And those two truths are that I am a moral failure who needs external rescue. And pretty much this is it's a one sentence answer. But if you look across the board at other religions, other belief systems, their philosophies, they never identify your primary problem as you're utterly corrupt. They have a much more positive view of human nature. The Bible's very, and actually this, I'm not, you can see in the book, but I actually quote extensively from Stephen Prothero, his book, God Is Not One. He's a non-Christian religious studies scholar. And his thesis is that every religion has a different fundamental problem that identifies with humans. And Christianity is unique in saying you are completely morally corrupt and need therefore a savior, not in the sort of hallmark step, but in the sense that you need to rescue. You are dead in sin, and you need to be resurrected. That's unique to Christianity. And so if you know that you are a moral failure, you experience that on a daily basis, you just know how wicked your heart is, and you know that you can't fix it on your own. Like, oh, you can try harder. Well, no, that doesn't work. I've tried that. Then Christianity is the only game in town. And so that's one short answer. I think that's how most people, I think actually I argue that all people implicitly know that. You can't be a Christian if you don't realize that you are a sinner who needs not just a boost, but needs rescue. That's what it means to be a Christian, is to throw yourself on God's mercy in Christ. That's one answer. You know, one line is just, I just know in my daily experience that I am a moral failure who needs rescue. And the second thing I'd say is, just say that Jesus, this is a trilemma, C.S. Lewis's trilemma. Jesus is a historical figure who made the outrageous claims about himself. And those claims are historically reliable. And so we have to either dismiss Jesus as an evil megalomaniac or embrace him as who he claimed to be, which is the world's savior. Those are the only really two options. And it doesn't, you know, frankly, it's just not anyone who reads the Gospels. It's so hard to write Jesus off as an evil megalomaniac, but the alternative is he's God. So that's a really C.S. Lewis framed as a trilemma, but I think it's basically a dilemma. He's either objectively a cult leader or he's objectively who he claimed to be, which is the Messiah. And those are your only two options. And it's a one-liner. Well, Jesus is either who he claimed to be or he's an evil megalomaniac. And then, of course, you do have to back that up with, well, how do we know that the gospel is reliable? But it's a great launching point to additional conversations.
Yeah. And like you had said and shared with your background, the historical evidence for Jesus as a historical figure is so substantiated. But I think a lot of us, and even myself up until several years ago, didn't take the time to look into that and kind of just rested on this faith that we had had since childhood. And I do think there are a lot of Christians that are in this space today where I inherited this faith as a young person from my parents, and I've always believed that, and I've never really been challenged on that. And so we never really had to think about some of these things and some of the logical evidences and responses, but we're kind of getting past that point where we are facing more challenge and more objection for our faith. People are becoming, just as a culture, more hostile toward Christianity. So I think these are conversations that we more and more are going to feel the need to have. And my question for you is, if you worked in a secular workplace and maybe a well-meaning work friend just asked you why you believe in the God of the Bible and in the gospel, what would you tell them as your initial response? What do you find to be the most compelling and effective initial responses to questions like that?
So if they came to me and asked for, you know, evidence, right, I would probably lean on that, the trilemma or the dilemma of who Jesus is, because given my background, I can make the case off the top of my head of, you know, why do you take this fairy tale book, the Bible, why do you take it seriously? And I said, well, no, it's not a fairy tale. I mean, here's how I'll lay out, like, how much time do you have? You know, hours worth of, you know, a discussion of how do we know that this historical account is generally reliable? It's giving you a picture of a real historical figure. And you don't have to prove that it's inerrant at that point, or is it even inspired? You just treat it like any other historical document, and you'll find that it passes numerous tests of reliability. But then it's all you have to show. Then you're stuck with this person, this figure in the Bible, Jesus, and you have to ask, well, who was he? Who is he? So I'd go, if they're approaching you and asking for evidence, it's probably better to say, you know, if you can say, well, here's why I think the Bible, the Gospels particularly, are reliable, and then you're forced to come to terms with this historical figure. If they're asking you just how do you become a Christian, you might want to talk about your own story. If they ask you something like, you know, does Christianity work for you existentially? Why, you know, why is it? How does it help you in life? You might want to lean on things like, well, I think my ultimate problem is the need to be reconciled to my creator. And only Christianity really offers me a way to do that. It's not just basically moralism. Like, just keep God's law. It's like, that's not, other religions say that. And in some extent, like secular philosophies say, just keep the rules, just do the work, be compassionate, be kind, do your homework, and then you can be on the right side of history. All of these are ultimately about self-salvation, whereas the gospel is about Jesus saving you. So it depends on the person asking the question, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. We were speaking with Peter Gurry. It'll air right before this episode. We've already had that conversation. He noted that trusting the Bible might not be as much of a hurdle as certain other objections, and like maybe the problem of evil. And to your point, different people will have different objections or different questions. What are some of the really common objections that you tend to hear the most from skeptics of Christianity?
So in my book, I list the three biggest, most common ones, the problem of evil, evolution, and then divine hiddenness. And I basically take the approach of saying these are called defeater beliefs. You know, if it's often framed as, you know, how could God exist when evil exists? So if you believe that the existence of evil it logically contradicts the existence of God, then you're done. That's a defeater for the entire Christian and Muslim and Jewish narrative. That's it. You're done. So you have to, just as a Christian, that we don't have to necessarily give them a rock solid, definitive response or theodicy showing, no, this is absolutely wrong, this is why evil exists. We can do that. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but all you have to do is say, hey, that objection does not actually go through. It doesn't work. So then they sort of have to, then look at the evidence. So, you know, it's like saying, I know that Mr. X committed this murder. And I just know that's the case. And you claim he's innocent. I know he committed a murder. You don't have to show that he is absolutely 100% definitely innocent. All you have to do is show that you don't have a good grounds for saying that. You don't have enough evidence. So I'm just pointing out here that we don't have to solve the problem of evil. We only have to show them that that doesn't work as a justified grounds to ignore the claims of Christianity. So in my book, I go through those three issues and just remove them off, take them off the table as ways to, essentially as a smokescreen to get around the claims of Jesus, to get around the need that we're need for a savior. I think that's, obviously you can go much farther in talking about those three topics, but I try to do essentially the minimal amount of work in the sense that I want the ball to be in their court. I want to make them wrestle with the positive case I'm making for Christianity, rather than constantly stepping back and trying to play defense and answer all of their 101 objections. One of the things I say in the book is that, you know, 30 years ago, you could say to someone, well, here's the case for the resurrection, say. And they're like, oh, wow, this is really, I never heard of this stuff before. I guess I'll have to read your book. I'll have to think about it. Whereas now they have their smartphone. They just grab their iPhone. They type in 1,001 Bible contradictions, and they're like, okay, here's a list. So they can ignore the positive case you've made and have you forever chasing down going down these rabbit holes and chasing these different objections that they got from Google 2 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. They're not these deep pressing needs. They're just a way for them to avoid discussing it. So I would just say, look, why often sometimes I've done is someone will be skeptical and they'll be reeling off these objections. I'll say, give me your top two. And if I answer these, will you then consider this argument I've made? And if they say yes, I'm like, great, here are the answers. Mm-hmm. If they say no, I'll come back with 20 more questions. I'll say, wait a minute. Well, you're not really interested in engaging in a conversation. You're just trying to get me off your back. So I think it's a fair thing to do. You prioritize your objections and then don't spend all your time running down these rabbit holes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these can be intimidating conversations for a lot of us to have. Sometimes we're afraid of the questions that we won't have the answer. Does it get easier? I know you spend a lot of time having these conversations and obviously writing about this topic. What's gotten easier about it? What's still hard about it?
It's definitely gotten easier. I'm at a point where if I talk to the average non-Christian about apologetics, it's rare that I hear a brand new objection. Like, wow, I've never even considered that. Mm-hmm. Occasionally it'll happen. I'll run into some argument in some book or something. I'm like, oh, I've never really thought about that before. But yeah, after a while, after, you know, 10 years of reading books and doing apologetics, you kind of have heard all the big ones. Mm-hmm. What that does though, is that it gives you confidence, because I remember 10 years ago, there, I had a lot more questions. I had a lot of questions I couldn't answer, a lot of Bible verses that didn't make sense to me. A lot, you know, so I'd say, oh, this verse and this verse, is that a contradiction? And I'd have to say, oh, it looks, that's pretty convincing. Maybe it's a contradiction. And over time, though, randomly, I'm like listening to this sermon, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this sermon addresses that contradiction. It's not a contradiction at all. There's a very good explanation if you understand the language or the cultural context. So as I had this, you know, I had this list of, say, objections or questions, and as they got answered, occasionally I'd get a new one to the list, but the list as a whole was shrinking. I originally had 20 questions, and then 5 got answered, and I got one new one. Well, now I have 16, and 4 got answered, and I had 2 new ones, and so now I'm down to 14. But the list gets smaller, and that gives you confidence that the questions you currently have will eventually be answered. So I don't have to freak out now. You know, when I was a young Christian, I hear one objection, I would literally freak out. I'd be like, oh no, this is going to be it. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I can look back at the last 20 years of my Christian life and say, you know what? If there's a question that really just throws me, I am confident based on God's track record that I'll find an answer. And I think that's a really good place to be in as a Christian, to say, I don't have to freak out and have all the answers right now today, because of God's track record in my own experience of answering these questions eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it can be such an encouraging process for Christians, no matter where they're at with their walk, because if you put the work into studying and looking into things, and I just started doing this a few years ago, and honestly spent a lot of my life, not looking at any of these questions until they started to just come up. But it's such an encouraging process, because you get to a stronger point of understanding. And that helps not only with, we've been talking a lot about conversations with other people, but it's also just so strengthening for our own faith as well, to your point.
Yeah, let me give one example. It's funny. So when I was a fairly new Christian, I began reading the Gospels, you know, regularly and really diving into them, I would look at, say, Jesus' teaching or his parables in, say, Matthew, then compare them to the same parable, the same teaching in the Gospel of Mark or Gospel of Luke. And I'd notice, like, wait a minute, the parable is a little bit different. The wording is a little bit different here. And sometimes even the same story would be told with a different application point. And, you know, I'd taken this skeptical, critical course at Princeton, taught from a secular perspective, where they said, yeah, that's just the authors making stuff up, like putting words in Jesus' mouth. And they remember some story, but then the author would insert their own gloss on what it meant. It's not Jesus' words himself. And so I'm reading this as a Christian now, and I'm thinking, man, that's, you know, it does seem like this story or this parable got kind of garbled in being told by Matthew versus Mark versus Luke. I mean, that sounds pretty, I don't know, that sounds reasonable. And so that, for me, for a long time, I was like, well, yeah, I guess the Christian explanation was, no, Jesus taught this story many times and it varied. He taught it in different ways and used different applications. And I thought, okay, well, that's possible. But it seems kind of ad hoc to me. So for a while, in the back of my mind, I was a little bit of hesitancy with the evangelical explanation. The funny thing is, how did that change? It changed about 10 years ago when I began writing and speaking on my own a lot. So if you look at the last, say, I've been writing and speaking for about, I don't know, 10, 15 years. If you look at my own canon of things that I've taught and said or written in articles, you will see exactly what you see in the gospel. I'll take the same phrase and put it in a different place, take the same story and reapply it. And it's exactly what you get in the gospels. Yeah. And so I was just like, wait a minute, this is not an ad hoc evangelical explanation. This is exactly what anyone would see if they read my work from 2007 versus 2017 versus 2023. So examples like that just took a little bit of this real life experience to realize this is not just made up ad hoc, you know, guesswork on the part of evangelicals. This is actually a very reasonable explanation. So it's an example of how things that once seemed kind of insurmountable now seem like common sense.
Right. Yeah. It would be more suspicious if they were word for word exactly the same, I think.
Oh, it'd be plagiarism. Like if I saw like, you know, a paragraph word for word, I've seen that. When I see it in primary sources, I'm like, That's plagiarism, dude. Like, there's no way you got those 37 words exactly the same in that source and this source. Actually, there's an example. I won't go into it. Example, I can give you an example of a scholar that I was reading, and her language, I read it, and I was like, I've heard that before. And sure enough, I found it elsewhere, and neither scholar cites the other one. So I don't even know, but someone clearly plagiarized.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, when you see exactly the same words, even as a just human being, a scholar, I got suspicious. In my mind, I remembered that. So yeah, if we saw all of the words exactly the same, we'd be like, something's going on. There's some shared source. Anyway,
right.
Yeah, interesting side note.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the lines that I highlighted in your book, Why Believe, was this, quote, "The truth of Christianity, or of anything else for that matter, does not depend on whether we like it," end quote. I think that's a simple but powerful line, as many listeners are spending a large amount of their time each week with a lot of people who are not only non-Christians, but maybe don't particularly like the core tenets of Christianity. And we are functioning in a world that emphasizes individuality and the power of our own selves to define and live out our own, what we identify as truth or as good. So what's the most important message that you'd like to share with the Christians who are out working in those really secular places, the places that will maybe discourage, ridicule, or even just paint the concept of Christianity in a very bad light?
I agree with that shift in how we think about the relationship between truth and identity and desire. You talk about living your truth as the height of self-actualization. I think some Christians are tempted to say, hey, let's just lean into that. Let's just get rid of these modernist truth claims, this enlightenment idea of the one objective truth. Let's lean into postmodernism and say, hey, just tell your story as a Christian. Tell how you came to Christ and how it works for you and the love you feel and all this stuff. And then you can convince people maybe it'll work for them too. And I think it's a terrible approach because God makes truth claims that are true or false. I mean, they're true, but he makes these claims. And the other, and so that's one issue to just leave off this idea that there is objective and even universal truth out there is to abandon things like the Nicene Creed. I mean, there's no Christianity without statements about who God actually is objectively and who Jesus actually is objectively and what the Bible actually tells us objectively. So you can't dispense with that. That's just non-negotiable. And so I think then for Christians, we have to resist then cramming our evangelism into this postmodern discursive style where we talk about feelings and warm fuzzies and experiences. I think it can be part of it. You can talk about experiences, but we have to bring people back to this question of truth. The other thing that's important is that Christianity, the big problem with winning people to a Christianity that is sort of centered on their feelings and their needs and their desire to have a story that fits them. Well, Christianity can get hard, and right, living a Christian life can be challenging, and it can start not meeting your needs anymore. And then what do you do if they're sold on the idea that, well, my truth is what I say it is? They'll abandon Christianity. Mm-hmm. So we have to call people back to the idea that no, objective truth exists and we must conform our lives to it. That's our obligation as human beings, and ultimately because we're God's creatures. God demands that we shape our lives around his truth and not shape the truth around our desires. So I just think, so the first step in a sense would be to wake people up out of their stupor that says we can shape reality to conform to our whims. That's just not true. And maybe the best way to do this is to show people what happens if they actually believe that, because they often will believe that in realms where they don't immediately see the disastrous results. But ask them simple questions like, what if you shaped the narrative around, germm theory based on what you like to believe? I don't like to believe people die of germs. I like to believe that there are no germs. Well, you would never do that. You don't go to the doctor and say, you know, doctor doesn't ask you, well, what do you feel like your diagnosis should be today? You go to the doctor to say, well, what's wrong with me and how can I be healed?
Right.
So you'd never go to a doctor. You wouldn't go to an engineer and say, you know, I feel like the bridge should look like this. And they'd say, well, that bridge is going to collapse. You said, but I don't care. I feel like this is the bridge I want you to build. So in all these arenas, we recognize that really happiness depends, ultimate happiness, long-term happiness, real happiness depends on you conforming your will and your actions to the truth. Yet in religion, we turn around and say, no, it doesn't matter. I can live however I feel like, and it'll be fine. And we have to say as Christians, that's not true. That's just not going to work. It doesn't work in any other arena of life. But I think it works in this arena. So interestingly, as a scientist, I feel like that truth was really hammered home to me because I say in the book, science doesn't care, or nature doesn't care about your preferences. Nature is just what nature is, and you have to shape your theories to nature. And in the same way, as Christians, we have to shape our preferences to what God's revealed about who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You use that phrase, like sharing things with people and seeing if it works for them. I think that's so much the attitude, the very arrogant attitude that our culture tends to hold right now is just that question of, oh, does that work for me? Am I feeling that? Mm-hmm. And we base everything off of that and have gotten so far away from the concept of truth. That's really helpful. Well, is there anything else, Neil, that you'd like to share with the Christian professionals who are listening in today?
Yeah, I think I definitely understand the hesitancy to evangelize, to tell people about Jesus, frankly. And I get that. But I do think even for people that are hesitant, there are ways that are sort of easy ways to, and there's some people out there that are just incredible at evangelism. It's their gift. They're good at it. They're bold, they're kind, they're not jerks, but they're totally comfortable having those spiritual conversations. That's wonderful. I am not extroverted. I'm an introvert. I got uncomfortable just making any kind of small talk about anything. And so it's hard to go from 0 to 60 on evangelism personally for me, but there are things you can do that are super easy. So one of the things I did when I was working at Duke is I had a stack of Tim Keller's Reason for God on my desk, a stack, like 8 copies.
Yeah.
Clearly I wasn't reading all of them. So it's not like I had one, I had 8 copies and they were not hidden on, they weren't like in a corner. They were like on the, we had like sort of cubicle type desks with shelves. It was on the very top, eye level, people stood up. There was a stack of them. They were just sitting there all the time with their spines out. And people were like, what's that book? I was like, you want one? That's odd. Why would he have a stack of 8 of the same books on his desk? Right. They're going to just naturally be like, what's that book? I'd be like, do you want a copy? They're like, well, what is it? There you go. Instant chance to talk about what the book is, why you enjoy it, and more about your faith. That is so easy. Another great way to be a little more proactive is to invite someone to swap or even invite them to give you a book that they really enjoy, that really describes the way they think they see reality. Like what book best describes your own personal views on what matters to you most? Mm-hmm. And so they might hand you a book by Oprah or by who knows, anybody, Deepak Chopra. But ask them and say, I would love to read that book, your favorite book that best describes your worldview, religion. And then we can meet and talk about it. It'd be wonderful. And even if they never reciprocate and never say, well, what about you? Even if they don't, it gives you a chance to have a conversation about things like what matters in life, the purpose of life, meaning in life, values. So it's very non-threatening. No, I mean, everyone loves to talk about themselves and everyone loves to recommend books. So that's a really non-threatening way. And then of course you can do like a book swap. You're like, you recommend a book. I'd like to know you better. Recommend your book and I'll recommend a book of mine and we'll swap, we'll read, and we'll meet together and talk about these books. And it's also very relational, right? It's not like this, you just hand them a chick tract and then they never see them again. It's like, well, no, we're going to meet and hang out and talk for maybe a long time about these issues. So I think, and then the last thing is asking questions. So just asking people, yeah, how do you spend your weekend? What's been on your mind lately? And that's, again, these are basic These are, I'm not, by the way, just for people that are getting nervous. This is not the gospel. this is not Jesus died for your sins and rose from the dead and repent and believe. These are just ways for people that are nervous and scared to just dip their toe in and have conversation. What I will say is that when people do come to me and say, hey, you're a Christian, tell me about that, I will talk their ear off. So This partly just my personality is that I don't, this is not just relegated to the gospel. I just don't like talking to anybody if I can help it. but you know, it's my obligation. It's my duty. I don't have an option of saying, well, I'm just not wired that way. God says, I'm sorry. What? I commanded it. I'm the king. You go and preach the gospel. You tell people the good news. So, but these are ways that we can do that. We can obey that command in a way that is for us when we're, it's better to be a hesitantly and nervously approach sharing the gospel than to just disobey flatly and not do it at all. So here's some ways we can do it.
Yeah, that's really good. I think really practical things that people can do because they can be intimidating conversations. And I've actually interviewed a lot of people who have said they're introverts, and yet you know, it's the call for all Christians to share the gospel. And so it's nice to hear those tips and things that have worked well for you. Well, tell us, Neil, we've talked about your book a little bit, and I'll link to it in the show notes. What are some other ways that people can follow your writing and dig into more apologetics content?
Well, yeah, my book, Why Believe, it's published by Crossway last year, and you can get it on Amazon, get it on Crossway, and it will give you a good introduction to apologetics. And I wrote it actually for probably your listeners' demographic group. So it was written with for Christian students at elite universities to hand to their professors. So it's now accessible. So my 14-year-old son has heard all the material. It understands it. It's not written in really complicated terms, but it has footnotes. It interacts heavily with atheist and secular authors like Bart Ehrman, Richard Dawkins, philosophers. Mm-hmm. It deals with all the basic objections. So it will be a book that you will not be embarrassed to hand to anybody. Like my wife gave a copy to Bart Ehrman. So, you know, and so it's that kind of book. So, and so for your listeners, you will not read this book and say, oh, it's a good book, but I can't really recommend it to my boss. My friend Michael gave it to his CEO at his company. So that's one way to follow me. I'm on Twitter at Neil Shenvey. I tweet too much on Twitter too much, but you can find me there. And I have tons of talks online on YouTube. You can find them. Just Google Neil Shenvey. I think I'm the only Neil Shenvey in the world. Okay. Shenvey's not a very common name, and Neil Shenvey's not a super common name. So yeah, if you Google me, you'll find me.
Sure.
And yeah, and if your listeners have questions, you're welcome to email me too. I have lengthy correspondences with people who have questions about different things.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you, Neil, so much for making time to join us today. It was a joy to talk about this important topic, and I know it'll be an encouragement to everyone who's listening in today.
Thanks, Miranda.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Word at Work. If you enjoy this podcast or get something good out of it, be sure to like, subscribe, and the biggest compliment you can give us is to share this episode with friends. Thanks so much again for tuning in, and we will see you next time.